best investors, the most successful guys, are the ones who hustle the most. One of the beauties and untold secrets of working in a global firm is you work 24 hours a day. And I think India is yet to have its healthcare moment. And these are large markets which are completely disaggregated, hugely fragmented, have massive supply side issues. And unfortunately, physical infrastructure, physical makeup cannot build a gap or bridge the gap between what exists and where it needs to be.
What is the global narrative on India from your perspective and vantage point?
So most people are quite bullish.
Welcome to the Indian Silicon Valley podcast. I'm your host, Jivraj, and today I have with me a very special guest. Join me in welcoming Karan Mola, who is the early stage India head and general partner at B Capital. Thank you so much, Karan, for joining me. Super delighted to be hosting you.
No, thanks so much, Jivraj. I think you've been very patient, but this is a long time coming. Really appreciate you having me on this.
I'm super delighted to be hosting you because I think looking at, you know, so many VC careers, I've been very fortunate to have some folks over on the podcast. I think your career trajectory really stood out and how you've been able to carve out a very distinct sort of personality in the ecosystem. So from afar, I've had the pleasure of admiring your career, and I think a lot of that will get displayed in terms of learnings today. So personally, I'm very enthusiastic to understand how you've gone about everything. Touching upon that, right, like what was unique in my research that stood out was that you studied in the US, but then you've been a part of multiple sort of 0-1 collectives in the country, right? And then you've seen these 1.5+ decades of early stage tech ecosystem really blossom. And then you've, you know, been in like leadership positions, making multiple incredible investments, including like FirstCry, HealthFiMe, ExpressBees, etc. I want to touch upon all of those, but I think where we might be able to start better for context is, and I don't want to do a timeline of events, but I'd rather maybe ask you some really crucial decisions that you'd have to make in the last 2 decades, perhaps. What were those decisions and where did they lead you? That'll be a good place to perhaps begin for context for the audience, and we'll take it from there.
No, that sounds good. You've been incredibly kind in your words, and I think it's just, I consider myself very fortunate. Because I've been, I think, at the right place at the right time with the right people. And sometimes fortune just favors you for whatever reason. So I'm very forever eternally grateful. And I think what hopefully the last 14, 15 years in venture has taught me keeps me on the steady path for the next 15, 20 years. I'm not as old. But I think it's the right sort of blend of being able to do this for a long period of time. And frankly, I think some of the people that I respect the most, whom I've learned from, are well, you know, into their third or fourth decade of investing. And just it's incredible to just be able to learn from them. So I'm very fortunate. I think it's still very early in my own innings.
Sure.
But I think some of those decision points over the last, you know, 20 odd years have hopefully got me to this. And, you know, let's see where we go from here.
Absolutely. Do you want to talk about some of these like crucial bits, right? Because they were not obvious decisions apart from in hindsight, right? You were part of the Jefferies team. You were you started another sort of collective, investment collective in India. Then you were part of, you know, IDG very early in the days. And then, you know, B Capital also making a footing in the ecosystem, and you decided to, you know, lead it. What is the constant maybe pattern across these decisions? What do you think?
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting question. And I do reflect on it sometimes. I reflected on it, I think, when I was having discussions with B Capital. Yeah. Whenever you talk to, you know, LPs and investors, it's always a chance to reflect on these things.
Yeah.
So I think one secret is, you know, even though the one constant is I've been in tech for 20 years in some shape or form.
Yeah.
But I'm not smart enough to be an engineer. But I think what was very lucky was I got an opportunity to work with Jefferies in tech investment banking in Silicon Valley. In the sort of as the market was starting to upturn after the downturn of the dot-com era. And that gave me visibility into just, you know, seeing how companies were built, what it meant to be in venture and startups, that whole ecosystem, because that's when everything was being rebuilt. And then also some of the people that I worked with who sort of seen that downturn and come through it.
Yeah.
When I look back, and at that time it wasn't very clear, But I think when I look back, I think those foundational elements were so critical in helping me appreciate, look, what is it that I'd like to do? What is it that I enjoy doing? Even though I was in investment banking, you were working 15, 16 hours a day, I actually genuinely enjoyed it. The one sort of critical part was when Jefferies was thinking about, you know, building out its practice and its presence in India. I was very unfortunate because the person who was leading that was someone I'd known for some time. We were from the same school, although he was a few years older. And I said, look, I think this is the right time for me to go back to India. This was early 2006. There was a whole thing of India shining at that time, which we, you know, people from that era joke about. But I genuinely believed it was the right time for me to go back to India. Why? Because I think I saw the potential of what hopefully could be for the next few decades. It was a prospect of building something new. Even the team I was with in Jefferies in the US was a very small team. And just completely by luck and accident, I happened to be in that team where I was working very closely with one of the MDs. And so I realized that I enjoyed the smaller group, higher impact, you know, not just 0 to 1, but just being able to come in day in, day out and create a little bit of a impact, even at a very junior level. That's, I think, what propelled me to look at, putting my hand up for the Jefferies office opening group, as it were. And then just, you know, we worked out of business centers, hotel lounges, till our office was ready. We created a team, created an infrastructure. You know, by the time I left, Jefferies were, India was probably the second or third largest office for, by revenue for Jefferies at that time, outside of the US, which was significant. I think after business school, I was very clear about coming back to India. Again, that's a decision at that time, I think I did question it initially. But when I look back, I think it was by far, you know, the best decision I made. And I was very clear that I wanted to continue to be in tech, as every investment banker does want to get on the other side of it, but really focus on an area where I can have an impact. I don't start my career by just, modeling and doing a lot of financial and analysis. I'd done that, but I wanted to move away from that. So venture was the obvious choice. Within venture, 2010, there was like 5 or 6 funds really that were doing venture, right? There was the precursor to Accel, Sequoia, IDG, the precursor to Kalari, and Nexus and Helion. That was pretty much it. I may have missed 1 or 2 people, but I think that was by and large it. And I happened to know one of the founders at IDG. I think just serendipity worked. My friend Ritesh, who then helped set up Stellaris, had just left IDG. And it was very early in IDG's sort of evolution. So I joined when we had, I think, 6 companies. And again, the world was coming out of the global financial crisis. Yeah. So it's a constant with my team that I graduate from college and go into a job as we're coming out of crisis.
Right.
And I think that really set the bar for the next 12 years that I was there. I can spend hours talking about what I learned, what I gained, what I realized about myself. And I think it was the amalgamation of those 12 years, which ultimately culminated in, the opportunity to be capital. And, that was almost 2 years ago. So time just flies. So those are some of the critical decision points and inflection points that we talked about in our history. And I'm curious to see what the next inflection point will be. It's not necessarily a change of job, but I think it's a question of, look, where do you see yourself growing and learning? I think that's very important to me.
Absolutely.
Even within IDG at 12 years, I think I had 4 or 5 different inflection points. And I think that's what I look forward to.
Lovely. I think that's super interesting to hear, and a lot of interesting cues for, early careers and how you can look at them. For me, what stood out was exactly 2 things that you mentioned as well, that your early bet for India, right, for somebody who was in the US and for somebody who also studied B school outside, it would be a very easy call to also continue doing those jobs, being in those geographies, but you bet on India very early. And also the fact that you've spoken about, thriving in these early teams and setting them up and really establishing things from scratch, sort of having maybe like a founder mindset to investing as well. That's been really distinct that I observed through your other conversations also in the past. So that was nice. But two things that come to mind here, right? I think as somebody who's been, and I'll stereotype here, a career sort of investor, right, who's not operated per se or built a company in the past, there's a lot of chatter in terms of, okay, what kind of investors really win in the long run, right? And then there's this one side who will always say that, okay, you know, investors should be founders and only then do you have the maybe right or, you know, whatnot to really work with great founders. And then there's this other side which prefers, you know, career investors per se. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. How have you sort of looked at what really works, what doesn't? You've also seen a venture in India really involved, right? So you've seen peers also do well and you've evaluated them in some shape or form. What do you think works?
I think it's always, it's hard to come up with one answer. But I think it's a very fair point. Ultimately, there are two or three different types or archetypes of investors, right? There is the operator VC, there is a career VC, and then there is the VC that has, you know, come into a particular area because of not necessarily being a founder or an operator, but just industry experience or having consulting experience. And I think all of them work. I think ultimately, it really, really boils down to the individual. And what is it that they're seeking out of it? Let me relate it to how it worked for me, right? I realized as I was going to business school, I did have the option or at least the choice to go down the path of seeking an operating role. And what I felt was a little bit of a blind spot, to be very honest, because I'd done 5 years of investment banking. Yeah, I'd done zero to one, but I hadn't really seen what it means to operate a company, right?
Yeah.
And what I realized was, at least at that point, you know, India was so nascent on the venture and startup ecosystem. It's funny, right? Just to backstory, one of the first people I met when I moved from the US to India with Jefferies was Vijay, VSS.
Yeah.
He was running 197. He'd raised, I think, his first round from, I think it was Intel Capital, but met him at a conference. I met him recently and he still remembers it. So I was like, either you've got a phenomenal memory or you're, and he's incredibly kind also. But that's kind of where we were just a couple of years after that. So when I look back retrospectively, what that allowed me to do was cover my blind spots by just the sheer factor of time. And also working with Marek and Sudhir and TCM at IDG and then Chirate for the first 2 to 3 years at least, just understanding the basics of, look, what does it mean to work with founders who are running businesses, you have no idea about what you're doing. Yeah. And so I always try that back into, you know, it's a decision at a point in time, in the market at a point in time. Mm. Whether that works today or not, again, is down to the individual. But I think today you have to work incredibly harder to be a career VC and be really successful.
Yeah.
And I think success has many forms. Now, but I think understanding those blind spots is important because there's, you know, whatever, 15 years hence, the forward, the market is a lot more evolved.
Yeah.
But the way I looked at it was, whenever someone does ask me for my opinion, my guiding principle always has been, look, venture investing is an apprenticeship. It was, it is, and it will always be, whether you've been a career VC or an operator. Because you get to do and learn so much by first watching, then doing, and then leading. You can't short-circuit the process. And I think that's where I had tremendous guidance and support. In fact, everybody who is at Chirate probably went through that. So the ability to actually learn by having somebody else guide you on a day-to-day basis was incredibly helpful. What also helped me personally was I was not in Bangalore. I was in Bombay when I started. And then I moved to open up our Delhi office. Again, even within a small team, it was a micro-smaller team. I think that allowed me to make my own mistakes and learn from my own doing while I had the guidance of a lot of senior people.
Okay.
Now, that worked for me. But I think just the apprenticeship model is so important.
Absolutely.
Where I think I got lucky was, you know, my first ever investment was in a company called WeServe, which I didn't source, but, you know, I got to work on it. We diligence did and did all that stuff, and you had your time to do it, you weren't rushing. My first source deal was FirstCry.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can write a book from what I learned from what.
Let's hope you do someday.
But I think, look, that experience was phenomenal because it was understanding what it meant to create a business in one of the toughest areas of e-commerce and retail in general. Working with a founder and a founding team that was where execution was par excellence, world class, right? And I used to think, like, why is Supam talking about his warehousing and he wanted to see, you know, other warehouses of companies in Bangalore? I was like, I actually didn't understand at that time. And now, not now, but I think a couple of years later, I realized execution was so important to what he was doing. Mm. And that also, that experience also allowed me to, you know, build good relationships with other investors, one of whom is with, you know, my friend Mukul at still call it Safe at Elevation. And I also saw how other investors who had started at the same time as I did were evolving, right?
Yep.
As he started 2 months after I did in venture. So, I mean, just that experience was phenomenal. But I think you have to seek out those experiences as a venture investor. And, you know, hope that you're in a place which allows you to obviously flourish, do what you want, but also get pushed by the circumstances, by the people around you, both from a competition standpoint, but just also from a development and growth standpoint. And be in uncomfortable situations because that's what ultimately will help you with your blind spots. Now, this is from the viewpoint of someone who's been in venture for 14 years, right? Yeah. Not an operator. An operator will think very differently.
Yeah.
And I think there you have to overcome other biases and blind spots.
Right.
For a founder, I think it's always a choice of, look, what fund, what investor, what type of investor rather. And I think the founders who've made choices typically try and surround themselves with different types of investors.
Yeah.
Because they want that, you know, the diversity of thought, but diversity of action and diversity of, you know, being able to, being pushed in different directions to come to the right conclusion.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a very long-winded answer, but I think that's always been my advice to people who are on the younger side of things in venture and have the opportunity to do something operationally. I say, look, just if you, if this is what you want to do in your career, you have so many years ahead of you.
Yeah, this is a very long game.
Yeah, so try and do some sort of an operating role. It'll help, that can help you short circuit a few things along the way. And then you can always come back to venture investing because you have that experience then.
Right. To bring this to a close, maybe, right, on the other side, if you had to objectively point out the kind of folks you're looking for when you're building a team in venture, right, like what is the thesis there, right? It's an extension of the same point, but if you had to point out that, okay, these are the kind of things that I'm looking for when I'm hiring the next set of, like, investors in my team, what are they?
So there is a base case, which is true for anybody in terms of background, etc. I think number one is, when we talk about founder hustle, I tell you, man, like, being an investor is not easy, right? You have to have hustle day in, day out. And the best investors, the most successful guys, are the ones who hustle the most.
Right.
So I think that's one. That characteristic should never sort of go away.
Right.
I think the other is someone who is, and one of, I don't read as much as I like to or should. One of the books I really ascribe to is a book called Think Again by Adam Grant. I'm generally a big fan of his, but he uses a word in that book called confident humility. And it's, I mean, it's not that hard to explain. Basically having self-assuredness, but being open and understanding where you could be wrong and being able to question what you're doing. I think those are that's the DNA of the kind of person that I think will always be successful in venture long-term. Because you need to have some level of base level confidence. You can't be relying on FOMO or what other people are saying or doing, but you need to be open about how you think about certain investments, how you think about certain situations, and questioning your own beliefs, right? So I think those are two sort of base case things. It's also important to have that to be able to resonate with founders.
Yeah.
Because quite often, even when you're the managing partner of a firm, you're still managing a lot of third-party money.
Right.
But by then, obviously, you're also putting a lot. But certainly when you're starting off, your place at the table is by virtue of the firm that you are working with and that capital that you bring. So as an individual, what are you bringing to the table? And this is something I was told very early on. what do you do to earn your place at the table besides the capital that you bring? So that mindset of an investor who's coming in, I think that mindset and that approach is important. You may not add any value to the founder, but you may be just there all the time for him in small needs, just be there as a second sounding board. I think those are some of the elements that I look for. I think beyond that, then it's, if you're building a team for early stage, do you want a mix of operators, people who've been in banking or consulting or who worked in startups? Do you want ex-founders? I think that's how you maybe round out a team. You get the right level of diversity. But I think the base case characteristics really need to be there.
Interesting. Investor hustle and confident humility. Yes, I'll keep those in mind, I think.
Not my words, but I heavily ascribe to them.
For sure, for sure. No, this is very helpful. I want to come to the present day journey, right? But before that, I think the other interesting aspect is you spent almost 12 years at a firm. You grew up the ranks, learned a ton. And most people in venture end up, making that their life sort of stint, right? Because you end up, there's a lot of compounded effort that goes into it. Talk to us about what was the thought process behind making this, shift per se, to the extent that, of course, you can. Just curious from a standpoint of what led to challenging your own self in a very different way and leading to where you are today.
So I think in a different time, it may have been a different outcome, but it was sort of in the, not middle, but like the second half of COVID, right? So there was a lot of time for self-reflection. I was turning 40 a couple of years back. So for whatever reason, there was a lot of introspection that was happening anyway. And I do believe some level in destiny. So I think some of it was right place, right time, right thing. The way I thought about it was, I'd done 10 plus 11 years or so in venture. I saw myself doing this for the next 20, 30, 40 years. And I was very happy. But it, when I think back, because I don't think in the moment I realized, but when I think back, I think a lot of it came down to my level for just wanting and to push myself, not for self-punishment, but I think just for overall growth. And being in a position where I can challenge myself or be significantly challenged, ideally a combination of both. And then it was a question of, look, what does this mean, right? And it was being in a setup which had been around for maybe 5-6 years at that time and had largely focused, to be capital, largely focused on growth investing, both in the US and in India. And the early stage fund was being set up, so had a chance to again build something from almost from scratch, because I think some of the early elements were there. That just excited me. I said, look, if I can take a chance on myself and bet on myself, and this can see doing this for the next 10, 15, 20 years and beyond, hopefully, but at least that much visibility. And then the other element was, I think, some of the people, right? So I think when I had conversations with some of the leaders there, which include, Raj and Eduardo, and they've accomplished so much in their, we're about more or less the same age, but they've accomplished a huge amount. And then the icing on the cake was Howard. And Howard Morgan, who's the chair at B Capital, he has a 40-plus year in venture investing. He co-founded Renaissance Technologies, he co-founded Idea Labs, which is the first accelerator, and he co-founded First Round. There's very few people who've had that level of success, and when you meet him, you're just drawn to him. You want to work with him and learn from him. I think that was the other one. And then I think just familiarity, Kabir Narang, who's the other one of the other founding partners, someone I've known for a while, worked with, invested with, respected him immensely. And so I think then getting to know some of the other partners also helped, right? And it's world-class talent that's been put together over a period of time with a lot of thought. And just everybody's there, somebody I can learn from in different ways. So I think the people played another role. And then it was a question of, look, there is a global element to it, which I've always enjoyed because I've had the fortune of being able to work and study outside of India and work here, very much a true patriot at heart. So I still believe in that India opportunity, but it was really getting the best of what was available outside and then getting the best of what's available in India and hoping to be able to put them together. And, you know, the vision and the long-term plan is much in the same. So I think a lot of those things, plus the timing and a lot of those dynamics, that's kind of what I think helped me make my mind. Like I said, it's been almost 2 years. The 2 years have just like flown by.
Yeah, that's commendable. I think, again, very interesting cues in your answer there. A lot of, you know, challenging your own self and a lot of just figuring out what's the more exponential journey you can be a part of, perhaps. And that's super interesting to hear. And that's also a great segue for, you know, what you're now doing at BCAP. And I'd love to know more with the caveat that, you know, India already has this sort of like venture map, right? There are a couple of firms which have been there for a while. They've been investing for about 1.5 or decades, 10, 15 years. They have like, you know, stage presence. They have a right to win. As a firm, you know, which is more global in nature, which has to set up an early stage practice that you're leading, where do you think, you know, multi-stage firms actually come into play in the overall sort of venture dynamic? Because in the US, perhaps in an evolved market, there is more distinction, there's more focus, there's more discipline, right? Here in India, it's still a bit, you know, abstract in nature, and for the right reasons, yeah. I'm guessing. So I'd love to hear your thoughts as to, you know, the edge that something like a B Capital can provide when, let's say, investing early. That's one. And also what your broad sort of understanding and learnings are for the venture sort of map when it comes to, you know, focused funds, when it comes to state-specific funds, when it comes to firms like yourself, which are across stages, which are across funds.
That's a very well articulated question. And I think I'll try and stay away from the answers one gives to LPs.
Yes, yes.
Because I think there's a lot of qualitative side to it, right? So there's two, three elements to it. One, I think my personal belief, in which helped in my decision making also, was there is still not enough venture capital in India today. I mean, it's there, but I still don't think it's enough for the opportunity that is sort of available. So yeah, I think a lot of there are funds that have been around for 20 plus years. Charati completed 15 years. So people have been around and built tremendous long-standing brands, will continue to exist. The market is also growing.
Yeah.
And without taking the US or even China example, right? I think if you look at how the venture industry typically evolves, there are, I think you start with generalist funds, and over time there is a bifurcation of having large multi-stage, multi-sector focused funds which are generalist, but also there is a huge level of specialization. Right. And then there is pure specialist funds.
Correct.
And those can work both at the early stage, at growth stage, or late stage. And specialist could mean by sector, by stage, by type of investor. So it could be just career VCs, it could be operator VCs. It could be another kind of, you know, control VCs, for instance, majority control VCs. So I think we're in that journey where some of this bifurcation is starting to happen. So I think that's one element. I think when you look at B Capital, so what are the key elements of how we're thinking about building out, right? Our presence here beyond what we already have. And, you know, again, to be very fair, like B Capital's been investing in India since 2017, you know, and Kabir's been part of this market for even longer. And there's a huge commitment to India. I think this is more a doubling or tripling down on the market being able to come early. Why? I think because you want to be able to get to the best founders as early as possible.
Okay.
That's true in any market, anywhere. Within that, how do you set up yourself for success? Right? So one is having local teams on the ground where you are still working through an integrated approach with your colleagues in the US or in Southeast Asia. And that happens. So one of the beauties and untold secrets of working in a global firm is you work 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
And I think that makes you work harder, but hopefully smarter over a period of time. That's what I think ultimately helps in the integrated firm model. It also works because there is a little bit of a focus in where we're wanting to invest. So broadly speaking, the way we think about life is there's three broad areas. There is technology, which itself is broad, but there's technology, there's healthcare, and you know now a third pillar for us is climate. And technology can mean a lot of things, right? So it includes consumer tech, includes fintech, so on and so forth. But I think there, we tend to be a lot more focused on the B2B and B2B2C models. So whether it's enterprise SaaS, whether it's B2B marketplaces or platforms, whether it's the infrastructure that's being developed around software or financial services. And that's where we are able to get in a lot of expertise, right? So by being generalist, I think you do look up, across a broad spectrum. By being a little bit more specialized, you're able to bring in both the investing side to it. There is a portfolio company side to it. So you get people who have been ex-operators, right? So we have a team of about 25 people across India, Singapore, and the US, ex-operators who actually work with portfolio companies post-investment. People who cover blind spots of people like myself and do it way better. And then we've got our strategic partnership with BCG, where BCG actually has multiple layers of how they're integrated within our firm, but also within the portfolio companies. So I think that model of actually working with companies early to late stage allows you to, you know, create a little bit of an impact beyond just being an investor on the board. So, you know, the term value-add investor is really loosely thrown around.
Yeah.
But at least when what I saw before I joined, I've seen in tremendous amount of detail after joining, is that is actually what, you know, B Capital does, right? Because of the model that has been used to set it up. That provides a very different kind of an edge. Not every firm has to do it, not every firm does it, but I think that's what creates you know, a differentiation for the founder, right? When they're looking at investors. So I think those three things really help you set up for success and having a longer term view in mind, right? So we're not looking at, you know, it's not a short term in and out tourist VC model, which a lot of people end up doing, and that ends up hurting their reputation, right? It's about having local networks, local presence, but globally integrated and working towards that day in, day out. It's about having a little bit of an approach on a few sectors, but going much deeper inside them, where we think there are large market opportunities, right?
Right.
And it's then being able to work with founders on actually creating the value on ground, not by necessarily the investing partner, but by the group of people that is composed, that B Capital is composed of, plus our partnership with BCG. So there's a lot of other elements, but I think these are the sort of broad guiding factors. And that's what we try and improve and refine day in, day out, week in, week out, year in, year out. I think that's kind of where, as the market evolves and bifurcates, I think that's where also being multi-stage adds value, because then you're able to continue to support, you know, founders up and down.
Across the company. Yeah, that's fair. I think no, that provides a lot of distinct clarity to how the market is evolving and how you're looking at, you know, the B Capital thesis per se. The other thing you're also doing is also focusing on Southeast Asia, if I'm not wrong. And that also brings another interesting angle to the entire lens, which is, you know, around pattern matching.
Mm-hmm.
This is another sort of overused term in venture. And there's always this debate to, okay, is RVCs in the, you know, role of identifying pattern matchers, or are you in the role of, you know, identifying pattern breakers, right? Because so much of the job is to identify outliers per se. What I'd love to understand from you is, how do you, you know, see the India plus one sort of geographies evolve? How much of the India model, the US model, and the learnings through the global partners can actually be replicated in some of these geographies? And in turn, how do you look at this pattern matching dichotomy, right? Like, what is the entire, do you stand to lose because you are pattern matching too much and not be able to identify outliers? How does that bit work?
No, look, it's a very nuanced question. And one realization I had some time back, and I'm sure others have added, is at least in India, venture investing is a lot more, it's less thesis driven, but it's a lot more by what you're seeing on the ground, much more bottom up trend, and hence founder driven.
Right.
I don't think Southeast Asia is any different. I think the US, you can, because the market is slightly more structured, a little bit more, you know, where there's less disinformation or misinformation in some cases, you're able to build a little bit more of a top-down approach. So with that in mind, I think there is a bit of the understanding that, yeah, look, you can look at a few themes that worked well in India and try and superimpose those in Southeast Asia. And let's not call Southeast Asia by region, but let's say Indonesia, because that's the largest market. And there are some obvious similarities in India versus Indonesia, some very obvious dissimilarities. So then how do you actually figure out, look, what will work, what's not? My realization, having not necessarily invested in Southeast Asia besides Singapore previously, was to look at models which worked in India, where a lot of the elements that created the success of that model, so not top-down, but much more bottom-up, were there in Southeast Asia, try and understand the differences, and then if you really feel that that's the right approach, go to the best founder. Because the best founder at the early stages will figure stuff out more often than not. You may still be wrong, but I think I would always be more comfortable and sleep better at night knowing that, look, I backed the best, what I think was the best founder.
Yeah.
And investing in Supam was the first realization of that, right? So I think it's a combination of looking at pattern matching from India to, let's say, Indonesia in certain areas. And, you know, one example that I can give off is a company that we invested in the B2B construction material space in Indonesia called Brick. Part of the reason I was interested and drawn to it was I had looked at infra market in India, had missed investing there. Srichirata, we were investors in Bizongo, so that was an allied area. But, you know, we saw what were the elements that made both those companies successful. And we were fortunate enough to get in front of Francis at Brick, who's the founder. And, you know, absolutely, we just loved him. Just, I said, look, this is the guy I want to be able to work with, and hopefully he'll want to work with us. And then we figured out, okay, does the model work? What doesn't sit well? Where do we think, you know, the challenges will be? And then we sort of went into it with our eyes open. But so much of it is just understanding the nuance on the ground.
Yeah.
And I think that's where having, you know, folks on the ground in Jakarta really helps, because I think as an Indian, you can go there every week, but you will still not necessarily understand it for what it's for what it stands. The same thing I think is true for people who come to India, right? So I think it's a combination of the approach that you use, but also the fact that you're willing to back the best founder in a model in a market that you think will succeed. And very quickly, I think the other way it works is when we looked at a few investments in India that were really building sort of SaaS models, for instance. Acacia is an example that we invested in, building, they're really building a carbon accounting and monitoring solution for the real estate market, starting in Asia, but then eventually we'll look at the US. And, you know, my partner Gabe, who sits in LA, he's done a lot of real estate investing. And a lot of his nuance and experience was very helpful as we were looking at the right sort of approach to, you know, investing in the company. So I think those are examples of how we are able to work together. And, you know, I think it comes with a lot of intent.
Yeah.
I think intent is what helps us get there, not, oh, let's talk to someone who's in the US and let's figure out what they're saying. We're actually talking every week, twice a week sometimes.
Yeah.
So that intent and that approach is what at least makes you know, everything kind of tick at B Capital that way.
Super, super. I think that's very helpful and gives us an insight to how global collectors work and how, you know, the venture art can be somewhat, I wouldn't say mastered, but manufactured in some shape or form.
Continue to learn upon.
that's better, I think. But the other aspect, you know, and this is something I perhaps ask all investors who've been on the show, is that venture is such a, you know, art of identifying outlier founders and in the moment, right? In hindsight, we've all been able to extrapolate what great founders have been able to do well. But to be in the moment and to be able to have the foresight that this is a founder who will be able to, you know, make potentially groundbreaking sort of moves, be able to establish new models, pivot when required, whatnot. The founders, you know, that are able to successfully really build large companies are true outliers.
Yeah.
What are your learnings in terms of identifying them? What do you think the founder outlier archetype looks like? Would love to hear your thoughts there.
So I'll preface the answer by saying you will be way more wrong than right.
Yeah.
I think accepting is important. You will say no a lot more than you'll say yes. And ultimately, as an investor, if you end up being successful, it's a little bit of a reflected glory because it's the work that someone else is being able to do. Sure, you're playing a small part, and you'll always play a small part, but it is a little bit of reflected glory in success. I think being at peace with that and accepting that is very important. Because otherwise, I think you get into the mode of, you know, chasing deals, investing, which is the easiest part, frankly. It's exiting and getting money out, which is the hardest part. And that takes time to understand and realize, right? So I think that's one sort of prefaced approach, which I think is important. I try and think through every day. From a founder perspective, I think there are many, many archetypes, right? We have a saying which I think personifies it really well, which is you're going after someone who's a Superman or a Superwoman. How do you identify them? Because they're not necessarily wearing a cape.
Yeah.
I think there's two, three things which I've seen on average kind of be common and links across people. I think one is people who are, you know, willing to run through walls to, if I can use the word, get shit done.
Yeah.
What does that mean? Like, and how do you stress test that? I think a lot of it, I mean, you can ask a lot of the right questions. You can spend a lot of time. I think it's ultimately the confidence that you are able to build with that person sitting across the room. Because if it's someone who's never had a job in their life, but they're you believe that they're just so incredibly special, a lot of that just comes by, I think some of it comes through experience. Honing your instinct to understand, look, what is it that I'm looking for? And you, more often than not, you'll see it. But it's people who are able to get shit done by doing whatever it takes, as one, obviously within certain bounds, and I think one has to say that in today's environment. The other are people who have very strong views, but clearly have the ability to listen and the ability to admit if there's a opposing point of view which, you know, doesn't, which countersedes their logic. It's hard for someone to do that, you know, per personal meeting. But I've seen people who are able to do that. And the third is just, as they think about building a team, even early teams, right?
Yeah.
They're already thinking about, look, how can I surround myself with people who are better at what they're doing than I am? And not being afraid to give them equity or give them the right sort of status within the company and being, you know, empowering them. You see bits and pieces of that in very early conversations. And I think one way to do that is just go to the office, right? And in a founder's journey, in the early office, will tell you a lot about how they're operating, how they're thinking. I think a collection of those three or four areas, I think gives you a sense of, look, what will make a founder tick and be that sort of outlier. You know, the other things which are equally important, but I feel are almost, you sort of, their check marks, they need to be passionate, right? They need to know what they're doing. They need to be really experts at understanding the industry. I think the why is much more important than the how of why they got into what they're doing. And I think understanding that underlying motivation, to me, that helps triangulate a lot of what one would look for in an outlier founder. And again, you may take the bet and maybe they just end up building in something which is not attractive enough, or the market is against. So five other things could go wrong. But it's hard to go wrong on a founder too often. And I think that becomes very important for you to be able to understand and reflect if something's go wrong. And I think,
yeah,
I think those are things which I still try and reflect on, right? If things have gone wrong. But yeah, I think to me, the founder sort of makes it work.
Absolutely. And that's super. I think, again, very, very helpful pointers. I'm always sort of curious to, you know, as I also figure out this journey, just understand how do you extrapolate some of these things in perhaps a couple of hours of conversations, right? When, especially at the early stage, you don't have as many cues, right?
Yeah.
So I think that remains a challenge for perhaps all investors out there. But yeah, no, this is very helpful, and I hope many of the folks listening will benefit from it. This has been interesting. I think we've covered a bunch of different aspects around the investing sort of journey. As we perhaps go to some concluding aspects, I'd love to understand in brief about some abstract things, right? And we'll probably go back to some of the things we touched upon, but maybe touch them in depth. One of the things is the India story, right? You've been able to see Indian tech evolve from what it was in 2009. So what it's looking like in 2023, right? And you've seen 21, you've seen 15, 16, you've seen all the business cycles. If I had to really ask you to summarize, you know, what happened in, let's say, the first sort of 2010 to 2020 decade. And maybe let's do this from the consumer lens, right? Like, how is the landscape evolved from a business's lens as to what they are willing to adopt versus what technology is required for customers, right? That'll be super helpful to how you maybe foresee large amounts of India heading in the future.
Yeah. And there are two fairly distinct, I think, periods in, we're probably in the middle of that second period or third period, depending on how you look at it. But the first wave was really a lot of tech-enabled businesses. And I think it took a lot of, it took time for a lot of investors, especially those who had been around for a period of time, to understand that, that look, core tech or tech innovative solutions will take time in India for various reasons, ecosystem, commercialization, et cetera. So then you had the likes of, you know, Flipkart, and I think we had some great companies in our portfolio like Myntra and Perskai and Lenskart. But these are all tech-enabled businesses. And if you look at large success stories of that era, right, 2010 to 15, 16, all of whom are unicorns today, they're all tech-enabled businesses at the end of the day. What started changing maybe 5-6 years back was, you know, the, I think SaaS had one role to play in it. And I think that's led to, obviously, this large proliferation of SaaS founders, the SaaS ecosystem, the SaaS investors, and just the playbook of how to build cross-border SaaS from India. What has also, I mean, COVID had a little bit of a role to play in how consumers and more importantly, businesses adopted tech. If I look back, I think one area where everybody overestimated was this is going to change overnight. And of course, as things went back to normal, things reverted back to normal. But it's actually taken 3 years since COVID where that adoption is starting to trickle up. And I think that, the so if I take a step back, I think we always think India will go through this massive J curve. And in some cases it may be so. In other cases, India has its own growth curve. And so I think understanding what that means is super important, right? So if I look at, I think if I look at the next 10, 15 years, what are some of the large opportunities where you've not even had tech enablement in a large scalable way to have the real impact on ground? You had it in consumer and it continues to happen because we're still scratching the surface, but different models will evolve, right? Evolve. You've had it in SaaS, you've had it in FinTech with the UPI moment and everything that's happened thereafter. You've sort of had it in EdTech too. I think we take it for granted today because of a lot of the noise around EdTech, but you have had it in EdTech and it will only go up in one way. I don't think we've had it in areas like healthcare. And that's a huge need. And healthcare is so many things for India, right? Because we are, there's an India 1, India 2, and a Bharat. So there is just primary care, there is sustenance care, there is care for different conditions. And then for people who can afford it, there's things like, look, longevity and, you know, for the ultra innovative side of it around biotech. And I think India is yet to have its healthcare moment. And these are large markets which are completely disaggregated, hugely fragmented, have massive supply side issues. And unfortunately, physical infrastructure, physical makeup cannot build a gap or bridge the gap between what exists and where it needs to be. So it's a very obvious thing, technology has to play a role. With healthcare, I think my big learning is, look, healthcare will also have its own separate growth. You cannot push healthcare beyond a point. You can't push it the way you can push a mobile phone, for instance. So people, it's so much more a pull-based product as opposed to push-based, right? So that is an area I'm incredibly excited about. I think where we need to be cautious and understand things better is just how commercialization and growth will happen.
Yeah.
But it will happen, it has to happen, and these are large local markets. And you know, the other area, I think there's a lot around deep tech, especially around space and material tech, which will, where India will play a massive role, is already playing a little bit of a role. But the other area where I spend a lot of my time and hugely interested and passionate about is the whole climate and sustainability.
Right.
Because again, just bottom up, right? We are one of the largest polluters in the world just because of the number of people that we have. We have to find solutions to make things better. We have the ability to create those solutions. And there's a huge government push, right? So there's it's all bottom up and top down. Same thing, by the way, is true for healthcare. But it is again a question of just the pace of growth, right? So as an early stage investor, you want to be a little bit ahead of that curve. You don't want to be 10 years ahead of that curve. But I think for both, we're sort of at that inflecting point where I think the next 10 to 15 years will be a really one-way street in terms of how innovation happens, how founders who find opportunities or are hugely passionate, ideally both, will take to it, and you'll have an ecosystem developing because these are also fairly technical in nature at some level.
Yeah.
So generalist investors will struggle beyond the point, I feel.
Yeah.
So there's many other things which will be interesting. India's a very large market, but if I look at two large opportunities for the next two decades, I mean, these are very clear.
Yeah, I mean, awesome. I think they sound amazing. As a very quick extension and to bring this to a close, what is the global narrative on India from your perspective and vantage point? Because, you know, you get to interact with a global set of LPs, global partners, and of course, this is a huge area of interest and, you know, something that you want to focus on, which is why you're doing what you're doing. But what is the broad narrative on India? We all hear, you know, that everybody happens to be super bullish. But what's the sort of specific insight that you can give us there?
So most people are quite bullish.
Yeah.
Why? Because I think it's a question of what the global macro picture is pointing towards, which is growth and stability. And India does pretty well on those things. The scale of not just our tech ecosystem, but just the economy in general, again, is
massive.
A place where India scores well on. And how do you get money into investable opportunities? I think that the way that's been eased up and made it, you know, easier for people to access has been good. The questions that people have, really, and let me keep this now to our ecosystem, is just, I think we've had a good run to be able to show some exits and liquidity.
But not enough.
But not in a way that's, you know, people are looking for predictable or some level of stability of returns, that they know that it will happen and it will happen in this way. We're not there yet and it's okay. But I think we need to
be
cognizant of that and do a better job. And I think everyone in the ecosystem understands it. I think the other question that I feel is the level of diversity in our ecosystem. It's a lot of people who are very similar. And not, I don't mean where they've been educated or their gender, but I think just the thinking is
similar.
I think that is something which is definitely being addressed by people who are making that change happen in the middle of it. And that will really create the right set of, you know, elements that we need. Besides this, I think it's just a lot of the growing up that we as an ecosystem are going through, will go through. But I think keeping these things in mind, people in outside of India are, I've never seen people so bullish on India in, you know, on the investing side. Let me restrict it to that. It's sort of our moment to deliver.
Yes.
And the only thing I worry about, and, you know, in so much of positivity, it is upon us to be able to deliver on the promise, right, over the next 2 to 3 years. Because I think that window is there for the next 2 to 3 years. If we don't necessarily step up, then I think it'll be a longer haul to, you know, to sort of get back to this position.
Okay.
So I think that's kind of some of the narratives that one hears and sees outside of India.
Got it. I love how concise yet rounded that was. So thank you for sharing. Karan, coming to the last bits, I think this is somewhat a very quick segment that we try to do. But one of the things I ask investors and they fumble on, and so I'd be interested to see what you'd say, is that if I had to ask a group of founders that have, you know, that you have invested in, what would they tell me about Karan?
Yeah, I'll definitely fumble on this one. and you may get different responses from different founders. But I hope it's along these lines, right? I hope it's someone who's always tried to take a balanced view of things. So you want to be a friend to the founder, but you also need to be a responsible investor. And that's a tricky balance, right? Which takes time, and you have to figure out your own approach to that. But I think that's one overarching approach that I try and go to, and hopefully I've done an okay job. The other thing which I feel I try and do, again, is you know, being a founder is really a very, it's a very lonely journey. And it's a tough journey because you go through so much, not just up and down, but you just go through so much doubt and so much, things which sort of push you to the edge. So if you have someone that you feel comfortable and you trust, I think building that dynamic with the founder is important to me, because that's where I feel I'm able to help them, right? Not because I've been in that position, but just because I think that is one of the things that hopefully I bring to the table. And I think just giving them the ability from a capital perspective and network perspective and whatever else to go out and succeed and hopefully not holding them back. So I think that approach is there. So those are things I try to do. Hopefully founders, that resonates with founders, but
sure.
I think those are guiding principles that I found for myself at least, that work best.
Sure. No, that's super helpful. I think interesting answer. On the part of, let's say, talking about the successful wins that you've had, there are also the side to investing, which is not the successful ones, right? And there's a lot of survivorship bias, whatnot, right? If you had to share anything from the investments that didn't go right, what were some brief learnings that you would like to tell us?
Yeah, I think, again, without necessarily naming specifics, but I think sometimes it's been the case of just I know I've made the mistake of possibly doing investments where they may not have been necessarily venture returnable. Okay. And I think then you try and build out a path for those companies to create that sort of return. And it doesn't end up happening just because either the market isn't there yet or just it's the scalability is not going to happen in the way you think, right? So I think that's been one learning. Sometimes it's also, I think, possibly a founder that, I mean, so founder market fit is important, right? And I think that's a realization I took some time to understand what that really meant. But I think getting that wrong. At the same time, I'll also give credit to some founders where it may not have turned out to be, you know, the sort of end outcome that we would have wanted, but we still, and I should not say we, I think they ended up creating good returns for us as investors because they were, you know, tenacious enough, they were forthright enough to actually work towards something when they saw plan A was not working, plan B was not working. And I think I've learned as much from those founders as I have from the ones that run exceptionally well. So I think you'll always get founders where you're, you know, those that have been big wins and big losses, and the ones in the middle. And the ones in the middle, I feel, sometimes teach you the most, because it's a question of what might have been. It's a question of what could have been, both ways, but what ended up being. And I think what ended up being, I don't know, maybe just for me, I've just learned so much through it, both about myself, about a founder, about a situation, how to deal with that going forward, as I have from, you know, both ends of the spectrum.
Lovely, lovely. I think that's, again, very insightful. A very quick, fun question to perhaps end with before the last one. But if you could be, you know, the CEO of any company in India, let's say a tech unicorn startup, which one would you choose? And let's say you don't have to choose one from your portfolio or previous investments.
I'll give you a very different answer. The two sort of, outside of my family, I think the two passions of my life are sports and music.
Oh, interesting.
Have been a consistent thread for since I was a kid. I would want to be the CEO of a company that builds something large in those, because I don't see that today. Mm. And it's probably coming from a case of, you know, pure passion rather than anything else.
Yeah.
But if I could build something where there is large impact and hopefully large commercial viability in either sports or music, that would be it. If I have to keep it to tech, I think, again, without taking the name of companies, I think I would want to build something in climate or healthcare, because I think the impact of those is lasting well beyond your time.
Sure.
And I think it addresses really critical issues which maybe are overblown in my head, I feel, but I think that's where you can have force multipliers that go well beyond yourself or just the immediate people around you. So one is passion-led. The other two are also passion-led, I suppose, but I think those are maybe more in the realm of, you know, what we do day in, day out. And that's why I probably spend that much time in those two areas.
Absolutely. No, I think falls in complete line with what you've been mentioning throughout and speaks to your passion. So that's lovely. For the end, I think I like to end with a reflective question of sorts so that we can maybe end with wisdom that is more long-lasting and yet concise in nature. You generally sound like somebody who's been reflective throughout your career. You've been investing throughout. You've had global exposure. If you had to really maybe, you know, I wouldn't say summarize, but I'll stereotype here and maybe make it a bit more corny. But if you had to go back to, you know, let's say your, I don't know, undergrad graduating day, and if you could, you know, tell yourself a couple of final sort of learnings from all that you now know. Let's say if you could speak to your past self, what would you tell yourself and why? I think that'll be a good one to end with.
I think there's a lot, actually. So it's if I have to really distill it down to one or two, I was, and this is retrospective, I think I was very lucky that I figured out what I wanted to do now early on. So I realized in college I wanted to be in investment banking. Now, I can say I was lucky because I knew what I wanted to do, but I was like, the other ways, I didn't even know anything else. How do I know better? Mm-hmm. So if I take the second approach, which is the alternate path, I would tell myself that, look, be a lot more open, because I'm saying that today, be a lot more open in thinking about how you want to get to your eventual path.
Sure.
It's not necessarily what you've seen three people do and three people that you really respect to. May happen in a different way. Which meant I could have still ended up at this point in 2023 having done something completely different. And maybe have had very different life experiences. So I think having openness, and this is what I tell people even today, look, having openness and flexibility early on in your career is easier and better to do, because as you grow older, you know, whether it's responsibilities or just your own ability to push yourself in that direction becomes harder. Just, I think that's practical advice. And I think the second thing I would probably do or say is, you know, chase your genuine passions earlier, or at least side by side. I think life is not one of those things that you need to singularly focus one thing on, or on one thing. But, you know, the two things that I mentioned, I think those have taken a very distant second, third position over the last 10, 15 years. And that necessarily may not have had to be the case.
Right.
So to be full-rounded as an individual, if that is important to you, I think allow yourself the time and the space to be able to do those things. Because then you have very, very few regrets in life. Those are probably the two ones that I'm like, I wish I'd been able to do. But, you know, there's all, I can pick it up at 2023.
Never too late.
It's never too late. I think that's the beauty of life.
No, awesome. I appreciate the honesty and the vulnerability. That was very kind of you to mention. But this has been really nice. I think I was expecting a very in-depth guide on investing, but we've gone across and, you know, really explored some different spaces and interesting learnings. And you've been very kind to share with candidness a lot of your thought processes in general and a lot of your opinions, which I'm sure will help emerging founders and investors alike. Thank you so much for being on the show, Karan.
This has been such a pleasure. You've been very kind with your time as well, Jiraj. And thank you for the time and the opportunity. Great speaking.
Awesome. Lovely. Thank you so much.